Welcome to Telling Stories, the show where we explore the art of telling stories in sound. This week we spoke to the wonderful Sarah Cudden about two of her stories, The Paddle Out and The Wind Phone. We talked about glimpsing into other worlds, following your emotional field and relying on other people's ears. But first, we're starting at the end with Sarah's unexpected passion for
crossfades. I love just spending, and I think that's fine. And I think it does matter. And I think it's sometimes, in terms of a process, it's in those moments where you're fiddling around with a crossfade for just ages that you make other really big decisions. I went to work for a children's charity in Kosovo just after the war there. I was there to write pieces for them. Didn't know anything about radio. And I met an ex-BBC World Service eccentric character called Brian Anderson, who is one of those people who occupy a bit of a niche in the media. And he was building these little radio stations throughout Kosovo for young people to give the various enclaves a voice. And communities had been kind of, you know, pulled apart and...
Here, NATO troops disarmed Serbian police at gunpoint. The Serbs claimed they had been trying to withdraw from the border. It is tense here. NATO can afford to take nothing for granted. They know it will take not hours, but weeks and months to make Kosovo safe so that the refugees can come home.
Anyway, it was incredibly complicated politically. But yeah, young people had nothing to do. They had nowhere to go. So they were totally physically restricted. There was no real learning going on because there was no sort of school and college wasn't properly back in and functioning. And so, yeah, it was really powerful. I mean, that's where I saw the power of radio as an opportunity for telling stories and the importance of it as a storytelling medium. That was the beginning of my interest.
You do so much, like you will do things in arts and music and documentaries, and you know, you just cover such a huge range of subjects. How do you sort of spot a story and recognize its potential and then, you know, work it up into the kind of the end result?
I've always had an idea of what I find beautiful in the world. I would see things that were striking or moving to me, and I'm really interested in rituals around grief, how we handle grief and how we talk to grief. I think other ideas come from conversations, of course, and relationships and talking to children and old people. But it took me a really long time to have the confidence to feel it was okay to try and make work about that, that that was enough, that it didn't have to be something bigger.
Do you mean like you felt like it had to be newsy or something?
Yeah, maybe that it had to have a bit more of a sort of hard-edged... that a glimpse of something wouldn't necessarily be enough, but I think it's that glimpse that somehow, that often leads you to something and you find a new meaning through that.
It's so interesting, Sarah, what you're saying about going back to kind of death and grief and beauty, and those are three words that I think in every single interview we've done, they always somehow emerge. And so I'm wondering, A, if there's a connection between the three, or whether it's just that death and grief underpin perhaps every story, and the beauty is our desire to kind of make some, I don't know, understanding that we can live with.
I think that's such an interesting question. And I think that's exactly what is there, perhaps, is that those things are all bound together. In fact, I've just been reading such a wonderful book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow by Francis Weller. And he said so many things about grief being this acute state of awareness, being sort of so intimately bound with beauty, you know, with a beautiful place. If we hold it in the right way and allow it to sort of take its own journey, it can show us wisdoms that perhaps are very sort of particular, those things are very bound together, aren't they? And perhaps we don't always see grief as something that perhaps has a beauty within it. If we allowed it to have a place a little more in our lives, then maybe we would feel that and see that. But within my family, it's almost a joke, as families can joke about these sad things, that, you know, oh, that's really sad and troubling and upsetting. Sarah will really want to, you know, she'll want to make a program about that. You know, so, and I think that's always been my emotional field. And within my family, it's like, oh, gosh, there she goes again. You know, that is the emotional field I'm drawn to. And perhaps it is for so many of us, because it's just so profound, isn't it?
Sarah, maybe we can ask you a bit about Paddle Out and the kind of process behind it before we kind of delve into questions around it. Maybe if you could just describe what it is and how you came to the story.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was really rather dreading making that. I saw a Paddle Out when I was down in Cornwall, just on a very small scale. And a Paddle Out is where a group of surfers paddle out into beyond the waves to commemorate another surfer who they love, who's died. Yeah, so then I wrote up this idea, and then they commissioned it. So that was great. And then I thought, my God, how am I actually going to find a paddle out? So I joined lots of surf forums and Facebook groups and started to talk to people. And actually what I realized is surf, it has such a rich culture attached to it, and it's such a tightly knit community. You know, it surprised me, away from the stereotypes of the sort of hippie surfer bum and or the body beautiful surfer dude. You know, there's actually a really profoundly spiritual culture there. And once my word was out, then it happened actually that somebody got in touch with me. A group of friends in Cornwall lost a very dear friend of theirs, Ricardo, who'd had cancer for some time. He died, and they called me up and said, you know, we thought you should know that this friend of ours has died, and we're going to hold a paddle out ceremony for him this Saturday. It was like in 2 or 3 days, down on Fistral Beach in Cornwall near Newquay.
How's it going, mate?
All good.
You knew him as well, obviously. Of course.
Pass the phone.
Yeah. Pass the phone.
Pass the phone.
Marta.
Basically, we're mirroring the same paddle out that's happening exactly at the same time in Cascais, in Portugal. They're in Portugal, they're slightly late, usual. But nevertheless, they're trying to, you know, say goodbye, send their good vibes to Ricardo. Ricardo hasn't even lived here for not even a year. He lived here for 11 months. And can you believe this? It's just unbelievable, the amount of people that are here.
We're talking. I needed that sense of something unfolding. You know, I think they call it verite. It's that thing that is the truth. So that there's a sense that the listener can really experience this at an emotional level.
They're real flowers. They're real flowers to celebrate a really good friend.
And so once we had that recording that morning on the beach, that was a huge moment, really. And the other two voices in it, the other two main voices in it, are a surfer who also happens to be, he's a Christian as well, and he's administered various paddle outs. And then the brother of someone called Eddie Aikau, who was a very famous Hawaiian surfer. And of course, the Hawaiians are like the legendary surfers. And he died in the ocean. And he's the person that people first conducted a paddle out ceremony for. So then I spoke to his brother about that. And it was those three voices sort of. And it wasn't until I started to thread them together that things happened. You know, I didn't expect it somehow to take off in the way that it did.
I
on a takeoff on a big, gigantic wave, you're in super darkness. It's like being in a womb of a mother's stomach. All of a sudden, you turn around and you paddle. And you paddle and you paddle and you paddle, and it's hard to get in this 60, 70-foot wave because it's so wide. It's so wide. But you have the power of training that will paddle and boost you into the wave. You're paddling like this is the last wave in the world that you'll ever catch.
This other presence emerged. The ocean itself became this other force and sort of character in it. You've got this kind of ocean god almost who kind of emerged, and that was down to the way that these wonderful people described their relationship with surfing. You know, I realised that surfing, it's not just a sport, it is a path. The kind of spiritual transcendence that surfers have when they're inside the barrel of a mighty big wave is that there is this transcendence that I think Clyde in particular describes, almost this kind of glimpse of eternity or something. You know, they're out there in these incredibly, endlessly dangerous, powerful waves, and they're on their own, and it's very intimidating, but in moments, it's just utterly blissful. The power of the paddle out made sense suddenly when you understood the spiritual nature of surfing.
All of a sudden, you feel the wave picking you up and you stand up. You're in the curl of the wave. You're literally in the womb of the wave and you're moving so fast.
I kept moving around this one piece in it.
And your nose of your board is trying to nosedive, and you're trying to hold back your board from nosediving.
Clyde is describing the feeling of riding a massive wave.
So you're dropping down and you can't really see anything, but you're feeling it with your whole body.
It's really sort of energized.
You're feeling it with your whole body, with your whole soul, with your whole spirit, with your heart, with your veins, with your blood.
As a listener, you're sort of on the journey with him.
And you can't really see anything, but you know where you are on the wave.
They call it peripeteia. It's a Greek word for the moment when a narrative shifts and the fortunes of your protagonist kind of change in some way. Or there's just a complete shift in the energy of your narrative. Early on in a draft, I think I had that wave riding moment right at the beginning, and then I moved it to 2/3 of the way through, and actually it did totally make sense to put it there. It was just an interesting process of moving one piece of the jigsaw around to create the right arc.
You know, the Hawaiian people are very spiritual, very spiritual. The ocean has always been a sanctuary for us. We look at it as someplace very sacred to us. One year, we had a swell in Waimea Bay. In this kind of conditions, it's very scary to surf because you don't know where the waves are going
to
break.
I think there is a rhythm that you start to work with. And I think it's why sometimes I draw inspiration from playwrights and theatre. Like, I love the writing of Jez Butterworth, who wrote Jerusalem and The Night Heron. I because the rhythm of his speech is, it's just so perfect. And I think there's a rhythm, isn't there, that gives space for the emotion. But, you know, I really do rely on the ears of others as well. I mean, sometimes I do clutter things up. And, you know, when it's, you know, the search for the right music and the right sounds and things is such an exciting one, actually. It can be easy to sort of want to, oh, I'm going to pull this in and then we could have a bit of that. And then we'll have this other burst of this. And, you know, and you can get completely carried away. And I think
I feel very attacked right now.
You feel very attacked. I'm talking about myself, though. I'm talking about myself.
Sarah, I want to... You mentioned the word glimpse a few times, which I love. I just want to kind of unpick it a bit more, because maybe we can just talk a little bit more about this idea of offering somebody a glimpse into something else.
I think the process of just pulling things away and giving space, and I know other people have spoken about this, but I think there is so much in that, because those are the spaces in which the listener inserts their imagination. And that is the moment as well when you are expanding the listener's field of empathy. It's like reading is like thinking with someone else's brain. And I think listening, it's true to say that listening can be a similar shared experience between you and a producer. You know, it's an opportunity to have completely different thought process in your head, but at the same time there need to be those spaces where you are setting the imagery with your own experience. You're given the sounds, you're given the words. And so I think when you're listening through to something, perhaps it is about thinking, oh, where could I, maybe we don't need that, because that's a moment where the listener will have their own connection. They'll make their own connection. I remember when I sent a draft of The Wind Phone, which is another one of my death grief programs. I remember sending an early draft to my exec, and the very beginning of it, I hadn't really fully translated it yet. The Wind Phone was set in Japan, so a lot of the voices were speaking in Japanese. Although in the end, I was sort of used a translator, but in an early draft, like the first sort of 5 or 6 minutes, it was kind of just Japanese voices and the sound of the wind and this approach to this phone booth. I remember Alan listening to this draft, which hadn't really been translated. And then he came back with a few notes, and his first note was, oh, at first I thought you were going to have this all in Japanese, and I actually kind of loved that. I didn't understand it at all, but I was just really, yeah, I thought that was quite brave. It really made me think about that idea that, you know, that is a glimpse, isn't it? If you're listening to another language that you don't understand describing something, you're just having to glimpse meaning and feeling through words that you don't have translation for. But that can still carry a lot.
それが電話で。
High in the hills above Otsuchi, on the coast of northern Japan, where the wind blows and the pine forests grow. There sits a white glass panel phone booth facing out to the ocean. Inside is an old-fashioned black telephone connected to nothing and nowhere. A phone where the living can call those who have died. I'm Miwako Ozawa, a translator and interpreter, and I'm coming back to Otsuchi for the first time since the aftermath of the tsunami which devastated this area in 2011.
You know, and when you put people in that place where they're talking about such a huge thing, losing somebody and a tsunami, and they're outside in the wind, and there's a lot of meaning there anyway, even if you can't really hear. I think there is a fine line between allowing people that space to imagine and experience and feel, and then, you know, ensuring that people feel held. But I think it's true to say that sometimes early on, certainly for myself, I really felt I had to explain everything and make sure that I had the background explained and that, you know, all of the bits of housekeeping were there and everything was, you know, and sometimes that can, like, it just doesn't leave enough space.
And somehow I felt human touch. Then I felt so relieved. Oh, all the tsunami thing was all dream, and she's alive.
Ah, yokatta to motte ne. De, anshin shita no to.
Then I woke up and I looked at the white ceiling, and then I realized I was in the temporary housing. And I knew that I was just dreaming. The tsunami was real and my wife was gone.
You know, when people give you their time and commitment, you know, share their story, their life, that is a special thing. And it's really important to ask the sensible questions, you know, the ones that will give you all the building blocks and the stepping stones if you need them. But I remember in the first couple of months when I was at Whistledown, someone said to me, you know, don't forget to ask people about the magic. I've always remembered that because and I've always used it actually, because it's really true that it's those magical, tiny, playful questions. And it's actually the word magic. When you throw that into a question, tell me about the magic of that moment, that people start to think differently and they start to feed off that idea of magic and they just start to talk in a different way. Yeah, I still use that word to create that, you know, change and, or, you know, to take the conversation in a new direction. And then sometimes real magic, yeah, does occur. You know, the physical impact that a piece can make on you, where you really feel that your body actually is engaged with what you're listening to. And I'd listened again to a piece that Eleanor McDowell made for Shortcuts a while ago called How It Felt, which I really recommend. And it's about the feeling of a kiss. And I found it really stunning. And so I was thinking about hugging, because so many of us have really missed that feeling that comes with a hug this year. And I've really missed the smell of my friends' clothes and, you know, just that total feeling of being anchored that comes with a really big hug. So that, I thought maybe you might think about, what does a hug feel like for you? What does it sound like? What does it feel like? And can you do something with that?
Can I demonstrate it?
Yeah.
I think it sounds like... but like softer. Softer than that. Like a squish. It's a soft squish.
I haven't hugged my mum for over a year.
Wait a minute, hang on.
She's been living on a boat in France for the last 4 months.
Wait, you cut out for a sec. What did you say?
Lisa.
She hasn't had a vaccine yet, and I don't know when I'll see her in person again.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know whether we're going to make it back. This is what my concern is. Oh! It all seems a bit mad.
Let alone feel safe enough not to socially distance.
Which is upsetting me. And I wanted to make sure that we could come back.
Hugging is one of the ways we communicate without words. It's an intimate way of sharing love with someone, and I miss it so much. So I'm trying to work out if I can hug my mum with sound.
If I thought literally, I think it would be a kind of like, where one person's got slightly too enthusiastic with hugging. So I think mum also makes a sound when she hugs people. She kind of goes like,
Come here.
It feels a bit weird to think about how hugs sound, because I very much think about how hugs feel, and they feel like kind of like warmth and closeness.
Kind of like homely, isn't it? A hug is warm and homely, like butter sizzling in a pan in a cosy kitchen.
A hug sounds like two purring cats. In an old chair by an open fire.
A hug grounds you, makes you feel present in the moment.
Is it different as that?
Like laughter. Hugging is an action between two people.
When two people really commit to a hug.
That's what I miss, I think.
When you just link in and you just fit perfectly.
Being present in the moment with my mum, both of us hugging each other.
It's a pretty special moment. And you just don't want to let go.
Hello, Jesse, these are my little friends. I wonder if you can guess who.
This is a voice note from my mum. She sent me a photo of our family friend's two kids.
And I know that you'll know them too. And
I cannot stress enough that this is a completely normal voice note to get from her. She sent it to me when I was hanging out with my uncle.
Happy to when I talk to you. And I'm looking forward to hear how you are.
My mum loves singing.
Lovely, lovely.
My mum's favourite thing to do at any time of year is to get me to sing Christmas songs, like church songs, so that she can sing harmonies over the top. We'll just be walking around or queuing at a shop or something, and she'll be like, let's do some singing. And I'll sing the normal version, and she'll sing some very, very high harmonies over the top.
Da, 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 da. Can't think what rhymes with does. I love you.
So that's how I've decided to hug my mum in sound.
Once in Royal David City.
Mum, you should be listening to this. I've texted you some lyrics, and I'm going to sing them now to the tune of Once in Royal David City. You sing along too, in your harmony that you do. And then we'll both be singing together from different places in a kind of weird sound hug, and I hope that it will feel nice. So I'm going to start with like, hello, like that. Hello, this is a sound hug from me to you. I can't wait to give you a big squeeze. In real life, it will be so nice. But for now, this will have to be enough. I love you very much.
Thanks so much to the wonderful Sarah Cudden for this episode of Telling Stories. And thank you to Jess Lawson, whose gorgeous response to the challenge you just heard. And thank you, Judy Lawson, whose harmonies and love featured in this piece as well. For anyone who wants to send me a sound hug, I'm all alone. Please do to tellingstoriespod@gmail.com and I will receive them gladly. Thank you for listening.